But then when those lines begin to hit, some interesting repetition starts to happen. You start to hear, like anyone who's read Hughes's poetry enough, you start to hear echoes of the poetry of Hughes in it. And it's just so cool to see it start to crop up and be the setting for these songs. And welcome back to No Script, an unscripted conversation about an unscripted conversation about theater's best scripts. I'm Jackson, that's Jacob, and we are excited to be back and chatting about another great script this week. It's interesting to be talking about this script in the context of like spring slash
Christmas in summer.
Christmas in spring.
Yeah, it's sunny, it's warm. And we're doing a Christmas play, so it's just how it goes sometimes.
It is. You can hearken back a little bit to the winter times, or look forward to it ahead, because today we are talking about Black Nativity by Langston Hughes.
Black Nativity is one of those plays, musicals, gospel song play is how
reviews.
Langston Hughes required.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, reviews. What it is crucially important in the history of this country, in the history of American musical theater. I mean, whether you know it or not, Black Nativity is almost directly responsible for many of the musicals that you know and love. And Langston Hughes is, you know, simultaneously responsible for a lot of the great literature out there because of his profound influence. So it's a privilege to talk about Langston Hughes as a person. It's a privilege to talk about this gospel song play that is like a major stepping stone in the history of the musicals in this country.
Yeah, definitely a first play of its kind for the American musical theater, at least the Broadway musical theater area. So definitely exciting to have the chance to chat about it today, and exciting to have the chance to talk about Langston Hughes, who we haven't had a chance to talk about on the show before. So all of the exciting things together in one grouping, and so get ready for that, and get ready for the conversation ahead.
Yeah, if you like The Wiz, if you like plays like The Lion King. Even plays like Hadestown to some degree, you have Black Nativity to thank, and we'll talk more about that on the other side of the break. But first, we want to ask you, if you haven't already, to consider heading on over to our Patreon page. Patreon is the spot where we get our funding to be able to do this podcast. It's not free to run a podcast. It's not without a huge time commitment to run a podcast of this kind. And so it just wouldn't be possible for us to do this show without the support of the people on Patreon. So if that's you already, if you're one of the supporters and you're listening, then please know this episode and all of our episodes only exist because you support us on Patreon. So we're saying a big thank you. If that's not you yet, if you're not a supporter, we're asking you to just think about supporting the show. We have tiers over on Patreon. I think everybody at this point in time knows how Patreon works. Different tiers, monthly amount, blah, blah, blah. The thing about our show is that we have a $1 a month tier. $1 a month, $12 over the course of the year. I used to say more frequently than I do now that I know a lot of people out there who would just hand me $12. Almost no questions asked. If I were just like, look, I need $12. Can you help out? So we think that that is a really affordable tier, $1 a month. For those of you out there who want to support the show, but who that's kind of the barrier of entry for you is the amount. $1 a month, it's a huge help to us. You get access to all the stuff that you can see over there. Of course, there's like different reward tiers that you can look at, but the biggest reward is knowing that you're contributing to the community we have here on No Script. So if you want to think about it, please head over to patreon.com/noscriptpodcast, all one word, no hyphens, no underscores, and we will see you over there.
Yes, thank you all so much for being patron of the show. Y'all rock. We'll see you over at patreon.com/noscriptpodcast.
And now, back to the script.
Here we go. We're going to jump into the conversation around this play. I'm going to give you just a brief introduction to Langston Hughes and to the history of Black Nativity. Langston Hughes, first time we've had a play of his on the podcast, but just an enormously important writer from the 20th century. He is kind of primarily known as a poet and a writer, a novelist, but he has a number of plays, the one of which we're talking about today. He's pretty well known as the leader of the Harlem Renaissance movement, or a leader of the Harlem Renaissance.
You know, when you think Harlem Renaissance, one of the first people you think about is Langston Hughes.
Yeah, yeah. If you think you don't know his poetry, you've probably heard phrases of it before. If you've read any kind of collection of poetry or listened to any poetry, you've likely heard a Langston Hughes poem.
I think the first time I heard a Langston Hughes poem, and I didn't even think to tell the story, but as you're describing the impact of his poetry, was in one of my favorite movies, The Great Debaters. Famously, sure. Denzel in that movie stands up on the desk and basically sort of loudly performs one of the great Langston Hughes poems.
Yeah, yep, definitely. Makes it, like, definitely in film, absolutely in theater. There's the famous poem at the beginning of Raisin in the Sun. The phrase Raisin in the Sun comes from Langston Hughes's poem Harlem. So definitely a very well-known, often quoted, often incorporated artist, and very important for his work as a writer during the kind of Harlem Renaissance time. A number of awards, just to briefly just get you a couple of of the many, many awards that he's had. He was awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship. He was honored by Howard University with an honorary doctorate, as well as Western Reserve University. He's got, let's see, I'm looking through the long list here. He's inducted into the Chicago Literary Hall of Fame in 2012, and just a large list of poetry collections and novels and nonfiction books and short stories, all sorts of stuff. Turning then to the play itself, today, Black Nativity is relatively one of the later plays he wrote. It was off Broadway in December of 1961, and it was one of the first plays written by an African American to be staged on off Broadway. So it's very important for that reason. It's kind of a production there initially in 61, then leads to a Europe tour in 1962, and that kind of goes like wildfire and spreads around a lot. A lot of its sort of ongoing success is from that world tour. But then it's really picked up by a couple, especially Boston, kind of hones in on doing Black Nativity often. And ever since 1970, so 9 years after that original production, there's been a production of Black Nativity in Boston, Massachusetts, which is wild. 53 years. Yeah, of really? Productions wow. of this play regularly. And the list of houses, Elma Lewis School of Fine Arts, Boston Opera House, Tremont Temple, Roxbury Community College, Northeastern's Black Man Auditorium, and Emerson College's Paramount Theater, just over and over this play is produced in Boston. Seattle does an often recurring production of this show, and it's done just all over the place, regionally, in community theaters, in high schools, and on the list goes. There's been documentary films made about this play, and there's been a film adaptation as well. It's kind of set into a storyline. It was back in 2013 when this film came out, but kind of set into a storyline sort of about the putting on of the show. So you may have seen that back in 2013 or in subsequent years. But this show, often produced, often up to this day, if you look around this coming Christmas, you will find a production of Black Nativity somewhere to go and watch. And I highly recommend you do, because even as we kind of turn to the synopsis in our conversation about it, this show is necessarily limited to some degree in what we talk about, because we have we can't hear music necessarily, and certainly Jacob and I will not be singing during the course of this podcast. But the experience of this show, the experience of being in the room, experiencing this culture, experiencing these songs, and the dance is a really important part of it too. So definitely this Christmas coming up, look for it around, because it will be somewhere within reach of you likely, and it's a great experience to get to go see.
Yeah, just a countrywide celebration is Black Nativity for 50 years, and its enduring legacy, whether you've seen it or not, is in musicals, because Black Nativity is really the first gospel musical. Black gospel music was not really part of like the mainstream rich white culture in America for a long time, and that was the culture that really funded the theater, and to some degree still does today. And so when Langston Hughes set out to do this project, part of the thing that inspired him was the idea of bringing Black gospel music into theater and making it the highlight, the central experience. And its success and its enduring legacy leads to now Black gospel music being a really prevalent kind of music in musicals and being, really, really popular. And so a lot of that is credit to Langston Hughes. As you said, Jackson, it makes it difficult for us to talk about. We're going to, because it's so fascinating as a story. It's so fascinating as an idea. But in honesty, like the plot and the characters and things like that are not really the center of the experience. Maybe Langston Hughes would disagree because it's the Christmas story. But I just mean that, like, let's say 75% of this play, like, literally is just the performance of gospel music. Incredible performance. I mean, watch videos online. This is a great time for us to say, like, Jackson and I are just two white guys. We love talking about scripts. Part of our mission is to bring interesting scripts into conversation. And so we're going to do that. But we also believe in you finding other places to hear these, hear conversations, participate in conversations. So we'll link a couple of other places that you can listen to conversations about this play, which probably will also include some clips of the performance. And I definitely know of at least one video where a Black gospel historian spends a lot of time talking about the actual quality of the music itself. All that super important. Check it out, because this is an experience play. I mean, it is the music, the dancing, as you said. That's what the play is. Around it is a nativity play. I mean, the first lines of this play are, "It came to pass in those days that there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus." Yep. And it is as familiar a nativity play as you know. We'll talk about some of the differences. But I don't think that Langston Hughes set out to, like, subvert the nativity story in some way. It's pretty straight up presented. Now, interspersed with, again, about 75% of this show is the performance of incredible, original gospel music written for Black Nativity, as well as some of the classic Black hymns, as well as, like, Christmas songs with that gospel flair. So imagine that this is a more like a concert experience or more like a church experience with a story in as we go. It opens, of course, with a great gospel rendition of "Joy to the World." And then we get the pieces of the nativity story, right? Mary and Joseph, there's a tax put out. Everybody has to register to be taxed. They go to Bethlehem. There's no room for them at the inn. They end up in the manger. They give birth to the baby Jesus. The shepherds hear from an angel. The wise men hear, you know, see the star, and they come to the nativity scene. That's act one. There's some interesting differences, which we'll talk about, including some very funny shepherds. But in general, this is like the nativity story as you know and love it, but through this Black gospel lens, which is with this incredible music. Act two really takes place in the now. And I say that, and if you're part of this podcast listening history, you know that I often criticize, like, the idea of something happening now. Like, but this, in this case, it really becomes a worship service led by someone called the elder, who really is more like the pastor. If you're part of the church community, you know that at least the mainstream denominations, pastors are elders. So the word there is a little tossed here and there. But this worship leader, these other worship leaders, they sing, they give testimonials, they talk about the power of Christ's sacrifice, they talk about what it means for us in the world. I mean, it is truly like a church service. with not a lot in terms of plot going on. It's more worship, song, dance, speaking, and it ends with sort of a reminder of how all of this is possible now because of what happened back then in the manger resurrection scene. That's sort of, I mean, in terms of like a plot summary, that's Black Nativity for you. Now, what I suggest that you do at this moment in time is pause, either go watch some YouTube videos that give you the energy and the great music, or there are great cast recording albums from when it was on Broadway. Just pull that up on your Spotify, your whatever, and listen to some. The music is the thing. The music is the thing.
Yeah, definitely. And that might be a good place to kind of start our conversation around the music, musicality of it, and the way that these songs really, like, certainly lean into the season, but also bring in so much more. In fact, like, my script, like, specifically talks about, like, bringing in kind of community songs into it if you want to. There's no score given with this script. There's a score available if you would like a score. But these songs are all Christmas songs. They're all gospel songs, and the script kind of welcomes in the chance for people doing this play to bring in their community songs into it, into parts of the play, and bring in the arrangement that feels the most right into the play. And in that way, the musicality is just breathtaking, and filled with joy and love and all the things, but also, like, has this really important move towards community and giving the kind of power of what center stage to the community, providing that medium in which to all come together and celebrate, but also to engage this culture well.
Yeah, a lot of the interviews that you can watch online with casts that are producing this show really talk about this piece of theater as an act of community service. Talk about how Langston Hughes was really interested in theater, which didn't, like, lecture artfully at an audience, but instead invited them into an experience of celebration. And I know that I said earlier that it wasn't like Langston Hughes was trying to subvert the nativity story and that he was trying to change it or really criticize it or anything. But especially if you think about the 60s, Black Nativity is a subversive piece of art in the, I mean, this is going to sound shocking maybe to us in 2023 or 2024, I guess now, but like in the idea that the Christmas story also belonged to the Black community and could be shared, sure, yeah, and told, and that could be something for everybody, right? I mean, I think that we know that there's a long history of like deep running Christianity in Black culture in America, but there is like the sort of racist attitude in America that is for Black people, right? It's like Black Christianity is for Black people, and white Christianity, that's for everybody, right? Mm-hmm. That's the kind of racist attitude of the prevalent sort of dominant culture. And in something like Black Nativity, Langston Hughes, you know, has the audacity to say, actually, this is for everybody. The power of the story, the way that we tell it, that's for everybody, not just like to get shoved over there in the corner. It's amazing. It's powerful. It's heartwarming. And it's for you too.
Yeah. And the way that this show like, consistently makes that argument, rolling out that argument over and over, this, like, just the level to which it's odd. I'm kind of like, I have a foot in church world and a foot in theater world and a foot in a lot of different worlds, but it's so interesting to have so much of that sort of welcome of church world in theater space.
Yes.
The move towards kind of this stretching out, this welcome, this hospitality in theater space is so beautiful in this play. And the way that the musicality and the way that the characterizations all lead you along that journey, I think, is really really well done, but really intentional, right? Like, you have the familiarity, certainly the like the Luke 2 sort of narrative that we hear during Christmas often adds this sort of like familiar tone to things. But then like the characterizations as well, all the ways that the songs kind of welcome in this sort of repeating refrain as gospel music does, really makes a space that is special and feels like is an invitation, is an opportunity to engage.
No, I love that you pointed out the like the familiarity of the Bible language, right? I mean, I think that this picture of like the nativity, Christmas nativity presented is like reading out loud from the Bible as it's sort of acted or represented by often children, you know, at Christmas time, at least now. I'm not an expert in what the nativity story's life was, you know, 50 years ago necessarily, but that's like how our community, at least my community, engages with it. There's an interesting thing that happens right away because it starts with, I've already said, and you agreed there, that, you know, the very familiar Bible language, it came to pass in those days. And it goes on. I mean, the first little chunk is just, you know, sort of straight out of some translation of the Bible. But it almost right away, it gets to the narrator, whoever that is in your production, gets to the point where they say, headed to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, with his wife Mary, being great with child. And then there is a line written. And the line is, I think, O Joseph, I think my time's most come. Right? Which is Mary speaking to Joseph. So right away you get the idea, I mean, you as the audience understand, okay, Langston Hughes is going to add some lines into the familiar Bible framework of this story. We get that. But there's also going to be this interesting theatrical thing where the narrator is going to voice the characters, right? Because the narrator is the one that says that Mary line. There's a Mary and Joseph actor on the stage, but it's the narrator who's going to voice those lines.
Yeah, it kind of like switches your expectation a little bit. It also like brings in Langston Hughes's poetness into the play.
Yes.
All of
it's
these
amazing.
Like, yeah, all of those, like those, especially initially when you, the first couple pages really of my script at least has mostly familiar, not quite word for word, but familiar enough wordedness to be like, okay, so we're just using quotes from the Bible in some way. But then when those lines begin to hit, some interesting repetition starts to happen. You start to hear, like anyone who's read Hughes's poetry enough, you start to hear echoes of the poetry of Hughes in it. And it's just so cool to see it start to crop up and be the setting for these songs.
And then later in the play, I mean, we'll spend some time on this later in our discussion, but I mean, there's like full out poems later in the play that are just, I mean, if you ever wanted to hear what Langston Hughes is going to write, one of the most incredible poets in the history of America is going to write some Christmas poems. Like,
sure.
If that sounds interesting to you, check out Black Nativity. It's stunningly amazing. But to go back to this, like narrator voicing for the characters, we talk sometimes about the actual feature of the script on this podcast. If you open up your character notes page in your copy of Black Nativity, I find it to be interesting that right away on the list of characters, you get woman, man, singers, narrator, old woman, four shepherds, elder. And then there's this category, non-speaking roles. And right into that comes Joseph and Mary and then also the three wise men's mothers. But I don't know. There's something about like opening Black Nativity, which I had some familiarity with already, and I'm, as Jackson, is like part of the church world to some degree, so I'm very familiar with the Nativity story. To open it up and see Mary and Joseph in the non-speaking roles category, I mean, they're, you know, other than the baby Jesus, I guess, they're like the stars of the Nativity story. And the Nativity story is their story in some way of being, you know, pregnant and desperate and, you know, in a bad place financially and in a homeless, not literally, but in terms of not being able to have a place to sleep in Bethlehem. And so that you open it up and you see that they're in the non-speaking category. And already for me, I was like, oh, this is going to be interesting. There's going to be something else going on. And the narrator voicing for Mary and Joseph, and then also for the innkeeper, I don't know, I found it really interesting. And it sort of brings the focus back to the event of the story, of the music of the speakers rather than like putting us fully into play mode at that moment.
Yeah, yeah. It's not like a, you know, it's not supposed to be a sort of slice of life engagement with the narrative of the nativity. It's like a celebration of it. It's a setting for it. And a way to kind of engage the moment of the season and all that it means in the context of this community. So yeah, I think it right away decouples our experience of like, this is not like, you know, a film about the nativity. This is going to be an experience that's supposed to evoke something. It's also
or even like a play, like in Black Nativity. It is performed in churches and stuff, of course, but it's also, as you said, performed in like traditional theaters. It's a theater piece to some degree, and so, you know, we expect like the characters to speak for themselves.
Sure,
in
yeah.
theater pieces, you know,
like a dialogue. Yeah,
right. Like
definitely.
They're a character. They have lines, and so this ends up feeling, at least now, in a minute, we'll talk about how that later in the play that doesn't happen. But right now, at least, this is more like in the line of a sermon, because like your whoever's leading your worship service, when they read, or even if they're performing like from the scripture, they read all the lines.
Right.
You know, unless you're doing like a fully enacted scripture drama, which you and I did many times, like there's usually a reader and they stand up and they, like, whether they're male or female or whatever, they say, and Mary said da 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 da, and Joseph said da da da. So it is interesting to me that like the forms of a play and a sermon are already like right away in this play pushed together, which of course is like priming us for act two, which just is a sermon.
Right. Yeah, it's pretty much a church service for the last hour of it, for sure. And then, but then on the way there, it's delightful again. We get another great reversal of the shepherds, which is like one of the longer dedicated songs in this play, kind of continuous songs, is the bit of the play where we get to live with the shepherds for a while, both in the pre-moment of the angels showing up to the shepherds, if you know the story, and the after-moment of what the shepherds are going to do now that they have been shown up by the angels, takes a good chunk of the play.
No, totally. So we have these shepherd characters who are, and I'm just going to read you their names, and then you're going to laugh wherever you are. I'm ruining the joke by saying it, but just be prepared. Ned, Zed, Ted, and Jed are the names of the shepherds. So that gives you a vibe for this extended shepherd scene. And so there is that part. It's longer, as you said, Jackson. It's also unique for the fact that now they are themselves.
Yeah.
Right? They
dialogue
speak
is
as
happening.
Characters. They're like characters in a scene. They have dialogue. They have lines. There's not a narrator speaking the story for them or even really speaking their actions for them. It's like a traditional scene, and they talk about shepherd concerns, right? Like, oh man, we're on the night shift. That sucks. That's not a direct quote, but that's the vibe.
Yep, for sure. There's like one of the shepherds who they're all kind of ribbing throughout the whole thing for being lazy essentially. Yep, and yeah, they're kind of commiserating around this evening spent in the fields. It's really funny then at the end, like this whole long section ends with like thunder and lightning crashing, and the narrator coming back on and being like, "So just so we're clear where we're at right now, reset." Yeah. Let's engage again.
There's a long song in there that, like, it has a little bit of a gospel message at the end. It becomes a little serious and faithful. But, like, there's a whole, really, it's like a musical comedy song. I mean, it's not really faith-centered or Christianity-centered at all. It's like how this particular shepherd is lazy, and because he's lazy, his friends aren't going to like step in and save him from his laziness. He's losing the sheep. He's all this stuff, and then it turns around a little more towards faith at the end. But that feels more in line with like traditional musical theater, right? There are characters, they're in a situation, and they sing a song that is, you know, intersects with their situation. It's from their point of view, right? The other gospel songs are not traditional musical theater songs. They're like songs that are sung by performers who are in the now, separate from the story. But this song is like characters in a scene singing from their point of view in the scene.
Yep. So it's pretty distinct. In the context of the script, because it's I would have to take another look at it to be 100% sure. But it might, in my mind, it's certainly one of the few, if not the only, moment when a character like sings their own dialogue in the script.
I think that's right. I actually think it might be one of the only moments that a character speaks their own dialogue.
Ooh, interesting. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, no, it's a great. So it's distinct. It stands out in the script. But then you're not done with the shepherds. Still, even you still get go tell it on the mountain. Once we engage the story again, and then we get the song, "Rise Up, Shepherd, and Follow." So we
Which
stay.
Is a famous song from Black Nativity, among the most famous songs that were like written for it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's a beautiful song, and very, very important song. And then you get the narrator narrating the shepherds still. So we spend a good amount of time with these shepherds in Act One. And I mean the distinctness of the scene before, but also the importance of their journey to visit the Christ child in the manger, really stands out and holds a lot of stage time and thus narrative weight in this play.
Yeah, it's clear to me that Langston Hughes really is impacted by the story of the shepherds in the Nativity story. And he really beautifully stages and writes the other parts of the Nativity story as well. I don't want to imply that he's giving them short shrift or anything. But the amount of attention on the shepherds It speaks to me of that being a part of the story that he really wants to bring attention to, right? These day laborers, these, you know, folks that work with their hands, that don't make a lot of money, that, you know, all the things, if you're a part of church culture, that you've heard about the shepherds, all that, right? That, like, those are the people who are first brought to the Nativity story, not to get sermonizing. But I think that is an emphasis of the playwrights, this idea.
For sure, yeah. And also the way, like, the script talks about light fades. So once the shepherd begins his journey, the stage direction is light fades as the shepherd begins his journey toward the star. The singers continue joyously in the darkness. One of the videos that I watched in preparation for this, we'll probably link it below, that Jacob already mentioned, actually, around the his kind of his story and music gospel authority, talking about the importance of the shepherds following the star and how following a star north is a narrative, especially in Black American culture and gospel culture. So that narrative as well, kind of landing with the shepherds following the star, also I think elevates their storyline in this play as well.
And right after the shepherd scene, you get two lengthy. I don't even mean to imply that they're too long, but in the course of the play, like solid length, just like outright poems by Langston Hughes. Mentioned this earlier. Like, Langston Hughes, the great poet, includes two original, incredible poems about the Christmas story that very much vibe with his social political demonstration, with his activism. I mean, here's a section from one of them, just a little snippet. Tell again the Christmas story with the halo of his glory, halo born of humbleness, by the breath of cattle blessed, by the poverty of stall, where a bed of straw is all, by a door closed at the inn, where only men of means get in, by a door closed to the poor.
Mm-hmm.
Just a little snippet of a nicely long poem, and I would read a lot more of that poetry, so I'm happy with it.
Right,
and,
absolutely.
And several pages later, another poem comes into play, and you just get to see Hughes demonstrate his everything that made him him in that.
Yeah. Definitely, you get to just sort of bask. I feel like especially the first act is just this, like, wow moment. This getting the chance to hear and see the story anew. And then you hit Act Two, and there's just, like, more wow moments going on there as we kind of shift the focus. The play does a good, like, just the narration shifts your focus to, like, oh, we're done with the direct nativity story, but we're continuing the kind of consequences or outcomes of that story being told. And we enter this, like, as we've already said, essentially this just church service, you know, for,
yeah, it's sort of like the vibe is sort of like gospel revival sort of deal. The big music dance ensemble enters marching, and the singing is, there's a meeting here tonight, meeting on the old campground.
Yeah, and there's the characterizations of the elder, certainly. There's testimonials throughout that kind of set the various songs that are being given, and there's the only other I think named character in the second act is elder, or I'm sorry, woman. So there's elder and woman, and a woman comes out and speaks her testimony as well, interspersed with the songs. So it kind of like resets a little bit, but all still couched in these incredibly impactful gospel songs and musical numbers. So it's not like it doesn't feel, though we have switched our mode a little bit, the consistency still like tethers us into our experience before as well.
No, absolutely. It's, I don't know how other companies have staged this. I imagine you could stage that the narrator in Act 1 becomes the elder in Act 2.
Sure,
really,
yeah.
Create, because the narrator has so much of the dialogue in Act 1, to really sort of bridge the gap between those two sections. But regardless of whether they're two different people or not, there is like a central sort of worship leader figure in both acts that leads us through, tells us what we need to know. In Act 2, they actually sort of set up the songs more like in a traditional sort of church service way. Here's the next song, here's why we're singing it, that kind of stuff. I mean, it feels like the sort of worship service you might have after you did a version of the Nativity at your church.
Sure,
you
know? Yeah, no, it definitely leans into the kind of broader societal context of a Nativity play of some sort, but also kind of puts front and center what a gospel church would be like. And gives the chance for maybe certainly if I were to go see this show, someone like me to interact with something that they don't get the chance to see all the time, but also the chance for folks from gospel church or Black community to have, again, the spotlight, have the kind of power to show their experience and put on stage for the sake of each other and the community and the audience and everyone what their experience is as a result of this. In addition to the music that is an expression of that, something that, I don't know, this is a harder thing for us to talk about on the show. It's, again, one of these, the pieces that make musicals interesting to talk about on the show. But the dance in this show as well, if you read any, I read through, a number of reviews of this show, and it always talked about certainly the director as a guiding force in the show, the musical director as a guiding force in the show, and the choreographer as the guiding force in the show. And how a show will, like, have a long extended run on one choreographer's choreography because it's so integral to the show. And the way that dance plays such an important part in both acts of this piece is really impactful. Again, if you have the chance to see the videos or go see the play, it's a really impactful part of this play is the way the dance continues to be used throughout the play in association with the music.
Yeah, I mean, in the script notes at the beginning of our script, there is something that I don't think I have ever seen before, which is a note about the mood of the show.
Yeah,
it says,
yeah.
Moods, reverence, awe, joy, and jubilation. And I think that note, whether you think it's valuable or not, I think it is interesting because it tells you the kind of church service that you're at, right? I mean, I think that in popular culture right now, at least, and this would not have been true maybe in the 60s when Langston Hughes produced the play, but right now, the sort of media representation of church services is typically like fire and brimstone sort of preaching. And because a lot of people are coming out of being hurt by the church and media and like broad culture is shifting, and I'm not really criticizing that necessarily, but this is a different thing than that.
Yeah,
you know, the idea here, again, I think is Langston Hughes offering to the wider culture the beauty, the celebration, the power of Black gospel culture. And you can't escape the church, because that is where Black gospel culture is born and where it still thrives today.
Yeah, no, it's firmly set in this sort of mode of kind of celebration, of gratitude, of kind of community welcome. And especially the second act really like homes in on that and like enables that sort of connection. And even I think even in the face of, as you say, the kind of contemporary valid critique of church and where some of the areas that it's been, it's helpful to also have this play in the conversation where there is a joyfulness, an empowerment, a expression of gratitude for both life together, but also life in association with the gospel and church. So yeah, it's a beautiful play in that way.
And it's I think the other like side of the coin, the other step from what we talked about earlier with the Black Nativity and the gospel music incorporated in that, right? There is this sort of, because of the predominant culture in power in America, there is this sort of racist dichotomy, right? Black church is for Black people and white right. church is for everybody, right? And I think there is a real power in Langston Hughes saying, you came for this incredible experience. You were moved. You were empowered by the experience of the gospel church culture in Act Two. Like, how dare you believe that, like, the culture you have to offer is for everybody, but the culture I have to offer is just for people that look like me, right? I mean, I think there is some, like, see?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, in that Act Two, see what this is like? It's not just, you know, it's not just over there. It's for you too. It can influence you. It can be part of you too.
Yeah, yeah. It carries that critique, but it does so by way of experience.
Yes.
By way of having, like, and now having engaged this, how has it changed you? How are you feeling? What was it like to practice this way? What was it like to engage in this way? And perhaps this can lead to some sort of change in you in future. I agree, a distinct critique, a subtle one. And one that's brought about by experiencing it rather than my reception of the critique is an emotional one. It's one that's felt. It's one that's kind of communicated through a feeling and a joy rather than sort of like a cerebral critique would be.
Well, that is this play, I think, is the difference between the cerebral art making and the emotional, the heart, the body, the go-along experience. Again, that's why I think the ensembles that do the show talk about it as a community show. Not like, community theaters do it, but I don't mean that that's the way they're using community. It's like a community service show.
Yeah. Right?
It's a hand out to the audience to pull them in by the experience and not just by like the heady, kind of nose up in the air that I think the theater gets a reputation for.
Yeah, definitely. And I think as we said at the start of the show, I think the kind of community-ness of this means that it's done all over the place. And I think while we're kind of wrapping towards the end of our conversation on this particular one, I just can't wait now for this, especially having now read it. I can't wait for this Christmas season to look around and find a place to go see this play. So if there's a chance for you to see it, if there's a chance for you to listen to the music is highly impactful. If there's a chance for you to continue in engaging this play by checking the description down below and watching some videos and things like that, it's a great way to keep chatting about Black Nativity. And we'd love to keep chatting with it about it with you via social media or via any of our various channels. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, or X at the username at NoScriptPodcast. We also have a Gmail, NoScriptPodcast@gmail.com. Find us on any of those sites. We'd love to keep talking about this play with you.
There's so many great things about this play. one of my favorite little things that happens is when the innkeeper tells them through the narrator, right, that they can't come in, and references the fact that Mary is pregnant. Right, like as a reason. I find that's a really interesting perspective on the Bethlehem innkeepers, that they're, they might also be full, but it's also like, you can't have your baby here.
Like, yeah, we don't have any midwives.
It's not a hospital. Like, you gotta go somewhere private to have your baby. You can't come into the hotel. I found that to be an interesting perspective, one of those great sort of story observations by a master of this, Langston Hughes. If you like this conversation on Langston Hughes on Black Nativity, if you liked our other conversations, please recommend us to your family, your friends, anybody you know that likes theater, storytelling, conversations about writing, nerds raving into the ether about the things that they love. That's us. Send them our way. They can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, YouTube, Podbean, all the different places that you find podcasts. That's where we are. Also, like the Facebook page. There's a link to the new episode every Monday. Easy to click and play from there. If you know somebody that's, you know, maybe not great with tech, can't search out a podcast, but they got a Facebook, they can listen to the show too. Send them to our Facebook page. Until next week, when we're back with another great conversation about another great script. I'm Jacob. That's Jackson. Thanks for joining us for No Script, the podcast.